From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We hope you had a great week. We're coming off a busy week on Connections, so let's get started.
The Rochester Association of Black Journalists is getting ready to honor three Rochester legends. Constance Mitchell, the first African-American woman elected to a county government leadership position. Dr. Walter Cooper, a scientist, educator, and activist, and there's a school named after him in Rochester. And Dr. David Anderson, a historical reenactor and storyteller. This coming fall, there will be a new children's book series featuring these African-American Rochester legends aimed at a third grade level.
There's also a documentary that will debut next weekend. In this clip, you'll hear Dr. Walter Cooper talking about why things have changed so much for African-American families in poverty.
When I was growing up, you had to have a near-death experience to miss school. My parents intuitively understood if their children were to have a better opportunity and a better life than they experienced, then education was the mechanism for it. And so you had to be in school every day, and you had to have a library card. And as I've mentioned before, that if you had a near-death experience, that was the only way you didn't go to school.
Why do you think that's changed?
It's changed because the families have changed. Historically, at the end of the Civil War, 80% of black children lived in a household with two adults. That percentage was maintained through World War I, the Depression years, World War II, Korean War, and up until the Vietnamese War. For example, when the Moynihan Report came out in 1965, you still had 70% of black children living in a household with two adults. If we look at the 2010 census, it's only 30%. And in Rochester, I knew a person who did a doctoral thesis in education focusing on Rochester. He surveyed 700 students who were going to graduate, 300 who would fail. And out of that 1,000, he found only 30% of them lived in a household with two adults. And if we look historically at the studies, the Coleman Report of 1966, involving 100,000 subjects over a 10-year period, the result, after Coleman and his colleagues got together and looked at this massive data, said that the family is the primary determinant of educational achievement. That tended to be substantiated by the late 1990s Federal Department of Education's Early Childhood Longitudinal Study. 20,000 students, 5,000 parents, and the investigators of that project came to the same conclusion that the Coleman study did. It was the family the primary determinant of educational achievement. Now, family structure is much more difficult now because of what I would call the wage despairment, there's a huge gap between the laborer and even middle class and certainly the richer classes.
So it's a complex problem, and it sounds like you believe it's harder for people, the laborers, the people at the bottom of the wage scale today than it was when you were growing up.
Well, yes, definitely harder because what I would call the parents who work two and three jobs can't be available for school visitations. The school that is named in my honor, school number 10, I robocall parents. I don't send letters. Because when you're dealing with a population citywide where for African Americans 16 and older, the illiteracy is 58%. So I robocall parents all the time, and I try to stress to them the importance of their children being in school every day. So the last 2 years at school number 10, average attendance has been 94-95%. And you're dealing in a district where the average daily attendance is about 83% or 84%. And we try to convey through the Parent Teachers Organization that your child has to be in school if the learning is to take place.
You gotta be there. Next, let's turn to a conversation with a man who likes to say that Obamacare saved his life. John Vito was a longtime restaurant owner in Rochester. He owned Obagalos on State Street, which was a very popular lunch spot. But in 2011, he lost 50 pounds and he nearly died.
John had kidney disease and he's still waiting for a transplant. He has a new project, a cooking video series called Cooking for Your Kidneys. In this clip, he tells the story of how his disease and his lack of health insurance nearly killed him.
I just attributed everything to the stress, the work. I had opened up the second place, Baked and Carved. I was working both places, morning to night. It just seemed somewhat reasonable that I would lose some weight and not be very energetic if I'm working from 5 in the morning until 8 or 9 at night at two different restaurants. So, but, you know, at a point you say, well, maybe something's wrong, and when it settles, I'll go see the doctor, you know. And when I finally did, he just sent me right to the hospital. I wasn't there more than 3 minutes when he said, you have a choice. I'm either going to call an ambulance or you're going to have your friend drive you who took you here. And I went in, and I didn't come out for 30 days. They put me immediately on dialysis.
What was the diagnosis?
Kidney failure, or end-stage renal failure at that time, renal disease at that time. It took them 2 weeks to do the testing, but they confirmed it was high blood pressure. So long-term, probably uncontrolled high blood pressure.
You could have died.
Matter of fact, the doctor said to me, and there were two things, two stories I tell. The one is, when I walked in there and he took my blood pressure, the look on his face was, I don't understand why you haven't had a stroke. And 30 days later, when I was released from the hospital, I had to make an appointment with him. And the doctor from the hospital called the doctor from my primary, and the doctor said, that guy's still alive? Like, he was, I think he wasn't expecting
me. I don't mean
to
laugh, by the way.
No, I know. And I think he was expecting me not to survive based on the condition in which I walked into his office that day.
Yeah. Well, and only because, you know, the last hour we were talking about health care.
I was listening as much as I could.
You're the first guy I ever met who said Obamacare saved my life.
And he did, you know. I mean, I think that there may have been some chances for me to get on Medicaid or Medicare, but, you know, the whole idea of eliminating the pre-existing condition clause, unfortunately for those who are complaining about it, it aided me.
So here you are, and this is a great opportunity, because if you ever went into Obagalos or Baked and Carved, John always had great conversations. Yeah, he was a good listener, but John always had interesting things to say. So this is your chance. You got a microphone. We're coming off the last hour. Anything you want to add to the healthcare debate right now, John?
There's so much. Certainly there are some issues with it. I think everybody recognizes it, but it's a big plan that does a lot of things. And if you're going to attempt to get rid of it and tell us you want to replace it, you've had 6, 7, 8 years, and then there's nothing. So it just makes you wonder if the complexities involved with this might indicate that what we have is mostly good and a small amount of bad, because you haven't come up with something that could fix that or could accommodate it.
Or maybe it's politics.
Well, I'm certain that that might be an issue. So anyway, I'll leave it at that, right?
Okay. Are you worried about your own situation?
Oh, every day. Every single day.
Because, with health coverage?
Oh, certainly. One of the main reasons is because the Affordable Care Act put some, and we may not recognize this in New York, but in a lot of other states, from my understanding, put a lot of restrictions on the insurance companies about how they could eliminate your coverage without cause. So that is an issue. And then what?
We'll turn to a discussion about gay conversion therapy. It's also called reparative therapy, and it's still legal in many states in this country.
The idea is that gay boys and girls or gay young men and women need therapy to become heterosexual, so they're sent to a reparative facility. Sometimes it includes electroshock therapy, but often it's counseling by religious elders. A new film was shot in the Rochester area. The movie looks at the harm gay conversion therapy can cause. It's called Fair Haven. We spoke to the movie's writer, Jack Bryant.
For a lot of people in the LGBTQ community, conversion therapy is something that is at least on the periphery of their vision, even today. A lot of people, like myself, come from an evangelical background, and so they're very familiar with teachings of Christian religion and other religions also that promote changing one's sexuality if possible, but at the very least preach and talk about the negativity of homosexuality, at least in their beliefs. So it's something that's always been kind of an issue that I've been familiar with, but over the years I've had family members who have flirted with the idea of going to conversion therapy or sending someone to conversion therapy. I've had friends who have gone to conversion therapy, and so it's something that has impacted me directly in fairly recent years.
When you talk to people who have been through that, was that some of the basis for the scenes that you wrote, these flashback scenes that show the main character going through that? Is that how you kind of learned about it?
Well, in some instances, yeah, I did speak to survivors, but then also a lot of research went into it as well, because there have been a number of people who have come out of these programs and have talked about the horrible things that have happened to them and have said, it didn't work for me, it doesn't work, it caused more problems than it fixed. It's left me with a life of shame and of psychological problems. So, I mean, there's a lot of accounts out there from people, even folks who started some of these programs have come out and said, we acknowledge now that it doesn't work and that these sexuality is immutable in this sense, and we shouldn't be trying to convince people that they should change who they are.
Let's close with a conversation about where the human race might eventually move if climate change or something else ruins this planet. NASA recently announced the discovery of the TRAPPIST star system. It's 40 light years away, which is not all that far, relatively speaking.
There are 7 planets surrounding that star, and all of them are rocky and Earth-like. That means they could be covered in oceans and the conditions for life. We talked to RIT's Roger Duby and Brian Koberline about this discovery. This clip starts with Evan wondering if humans could ever hope to end up there.
Should we be looking at this kind of discovery, TRAPPIST, the star with 7 planets that are roughly Earth-like, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. Should we be looking at TRAPPIST with any enthusiasm as a potential home? Is that ridiculous? Should we be looking for potential homes in the stars just in case we really can't grow up and make this one more habitable? I'll start with you, Roger. I mean, is that a silly question to even be pursuing?
Well, again, using the horse and buggy analogy,
yeah.
Yes, it seems silly. However, there are a variety of ways that we could short-circuit that limitation. It's not inconceivable to think that if another civilization has evolved on one of these planets, and if we can develop a way to communicate with them at the speed of light, that's not too bad. That's 40 years one way for a communication. Granted, that seems crazily slow. However, if they've evolved sufficiently and they've developed faster than light travel, some other
way. If they're ahead of us?
If they're way ahead of us in terms of space
then
travel.
Then we're lunch, dude.
They can send us the blueprint. And all of a sudden, and we can do a trade. It's like, okay, we'll show you all the things that we've developed. You show us the things you've developed.
And all of a sudden,
we've got two civilizations that are sort of cooperating.
I love this.
In trying to expand and become more galactic.
They have to be benevolent and not consider us to be lunch.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. Absolutely.
But you would hope that if they are evolved and advanced, that they would be fascinated to know that we're out there.
Of course.
They might be up there, you know, with Fermi's paradox doing the same thing. Where is everybody? And we
right.
may be the ones saying, we're right here, guys.
Yeah.
You know, what do you
right.
think, Brian?
Oh, I agree. I think it's one of the interesting things about the TRAPPIST discovery is, in many ways, it's probably a much more common solar system than our own. A star our size is in the top 5% of stars in terms of mass. So it's actually relatively rare. Only 1 in 20 have the mass of our sun. And red dwarfs, which this is a small red dwarf, are 75% of stars in our galaxy. So it is far more likely to find potentially habitable planets around red dwarfs than it is around anything else.
And that does it for another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. Hope you had a great week. You can always find us on Connections every weekday afternoon on 1370 from noon to 2, AM 1370, that is, and FM 88.5. Along with 89.5 FM if you're in the Finger Lakes. That's WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.